Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwarzstrauber. On today's show, online voting. There's a can of worms for you. We just had an election in the United States back in November, and cyber meddling in the election was a major storyline. And we just had DEF CON happening out in the Valley, where hackers were breaking into voting machines. But of course, there are other things going on with online voting, like the potential to increase turnout and what effect it will have on civic engagement and discourse. And so how do we weigh the potential benefits and costs of implementing online voting more broadly in the United States? Well, joining me to discuss this is Andrew Weinrich. He is a tech entrepreneur and host of the podcast Predicting Our Future. Andrew, thanks for joining the show.
Thank you, Evan. I'm glad to be joining.
So before we jump into the topic of online voting, it's always great to have a fellow podcaster on the show. So tell me about Predicting Our Future and what listeners could expect to hear on that show.
So we recently launched, I think we've got a total of 9 episodes that have come out. My career has been spent starting technology businesses where I thought there was an opportunity to be massively disruptive. So picking a vertical that I thought was about to change and then building a business in it. The podcast is focused on this idea that there are inevitabilities. There are, in some cases, there are inevitabilities. In some cases, there are just strong likelihoods that verticals are going to be disrupted. And if you're an entrepreneur, that's particularly interesting because you can focus on playing in a space where it looks like there's significant changes afoot. If you're not an entrepreneur, it's interesting just to have a perspective of what the future looks like. So the podcast is around identifying in different series verticals. So we talk about factory-built housing and how in the not too distant future, a majority of our homes, a majority of apartment buildings are likely to be constructed inside of factories. Now, that may be 20 years away, but it's not 100 years away. And then we just did a series on online voting. And in a time when you buy every product online, in a time when you pay your bills online, this podcast examines, well, why don't we vote online? And when will that happen? Or will that ever happen? So that's the podcast. And each series consists of a couple different episodes. So we do it usually more than one episode. And we will continue to examine other verticals and how we think they could be massively disrupted in the years to come.
Well, great. And listeners, go ahead and check out that podcast, Predicting Our Future. And we're going to talk with Andrew about that topic of online voting, which is potentially an area that is ripe for disruption. A lot of people who vote in their, you know, local elections and even their, I mean, you're voting at the same place regardless in the United States, whether it's local, state, or federal. And they might notice that it's just a very low tech exercise. And maybe it's not that convenient the way that shopping online is. So, Andrew, you know, there's all this talk in the United States about low voter turnout. You know, we see in some presidential elections, we consider it great if a majority of eligible voters vote, like, you know, slightly over 50%. Wonderful, right? But then you look at mayoral elections and, you know, in my home state of New York, we're 48th in the country in turnout. And often we elect the mayor of New York City with only 25% having participated and even less in the primaries. So, I mean, it seems so obvious. Is online voting the solution to low voter turnout?
Well, before we get to that, let me just emphasize, let me put a finer point on what you just said about how important this is. It's not just important from the perspective of that the president or any of our elected officials reflect the will of the people, but the ability to effectively govern is largely a function of how engaged the electorate is and the true support that a elected official enjoys. So this isn't just a problem that the people we're electing, in many instances, don't reflect even a majority of the voters. Now, it is true that in this last presidential election of eligible voters, we had over 54% of people vote, the lowest, I think, of any major Western democracy or advanced democracy. But in other elections, for example, our congressional races, which are in the off year when there's not a presidential race, we don't get to 50%. And certainly, as you mentioned, in more local elections, we don't get to 50%. So it creates a real question, not just about whether or not the elected officials reflect the will of the people, but it brings into question how effective elected officials can be without an engaged electorate. And so that's why I think this is a critically important issue. One other point when we talk about this. In this past election, there are a lot of people who point out that the difference between Trump and Clinton getting elected were 80,000 historically Democrat-leaning voters in the states of Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania that in this election voted for Trump, but who in prior elections would have otherwise leaned for the Democratic Party. What's interesting is 100 million people stayed home. 100 million voters stayed home. And so, you know, if you were an entrepreneur and you were dealing with a budgetary problem, you would begin by attacking the biggest line item on the budget if you wanted to course correct where your company was going. Here, when we talk about voting, you have all of these protests and that we've seen subsequent to the voting, and you can't help but wonder, did one out of two of every one of these people protesting not participate in voting?
Right. And there's a lot of reasons why people may or may not vote. And just to, you know, defend some of these stay-at-home people on election day, I mean, think about a variety of reasons, right? It's on Tuesday. Unless you are off from work, that can be wildly inconvenient. If you're a low-income person and you're voting station is far from you, or it's expensive to get there, you don't have a car, you don't have the right identification, that could be a problem. There's also basic cost-benefit analysis. If you are a person who's got basically not a lot of time, you've got maybe you're a single mom or a single dad with a bunch of kids, and you don't have time to do this. And if you're going to be stuck in line, maybe you live in a swing state, you don't want to do that. And then, of course, there's the problem where so many states are just guaranteed to go one way or another, at least in people's perceptions. And I know that that's a moral hazard. And the more people assume that, the more it perpetuates the status quo. But, you know, it's you could do a basic cost-benefit analysis, and I'm sure there have been studies done that say voting is not worth your time. Now, of course, there's other things at play like civic duty, and you mentioned a very important point of just about governance and whether, you know, having only 25% of the population that is eligible to vote having voted for you is a hazard in and of itself. All that said, do you believe that online voting, having it be a more convenient activity, would increase the turnout, would get these people that are otherwise not engaged to engage?
So you're cutting right to the chase. And it is interesting what there are surveys that are done about why people don't vote. And you are right that Tuesday is incredibly inconvenient. Proximity of polls makes a big difference. So we can definitely, and also this notion that my vote doesn't count, we can talk about the Electoral College and whether that really is something that should be discarded, which I believe it should be. But your question is, do I believe online voting would increase the number of people that voted? The empirical data does not clearly suggest that that would happen. But I do believe that there is a confluence of factors that would contribute, if we did have online voting, to an eventual increase in the number of people that voted, but that is an unproven proposition. I can tell you why I think that's the case. When you change something like the mechanism by which people vote, it doesn't change in a vacuum. And so we do know that, for example, in other areas where they've tried online voting, in Estonia, there's nationwide online voting, in certain cantons in Switzerland, there's online voting. Other countries have tried referendums with online voting. The empirical data is mixed about whether turnout increases. It usually increases after the very first time it's introduced, but it's unclear whether the increase maintains over time. I would argue that there's an entire ecosystem that's very developed in the United States around advertising for political campaigns and how the parties try to generate support. And if you think about the analog to an e-commerce company, well, the original spending on when the internet, you know, when we began to see commerce introduced to the internet and big spending, we saw a lot of companies that were engaged in branding campaigns. In other words, there wasn't an opportunity to click to buy, but there was an opportunity to change people's perspective about a branding campaign, which is largely how I think about advertising for political campaigns, right? When you advertise, you say, please support my candidate, not click to vote. You would expect that if we had the ability to click to vote, and if online voting didn't exist on a single day, but existed over a period of time, that the entire way that candidates advertised or marketed political themselves would change. And my guess is that over time, people would get very effective, both in social and in paid acquisition, on how to get people to take an action.
So if we were to try to implement a model, right, and you mentioned Estonia, there was also a online trial in Alabama for service members living overseas. You know, policymakers need some type of thing to go off of, right? They need an example. And while, of course, a tiny country in the Baltics might not be just, you can't just transfer the system seamlessly. And of course, the United States is extremely complicated and elections are hyper-localized and every county does it differently. And we saw this play out in the 2000 election with, you know, I'm going to beat up on Florida a little bit, but we had hanging chads, we had butterfly ballots. It was just a ridiculous display and frankly, kind of embarrassing. But is there a country that, you know, policymakers at the local, state, and federal level can look to and say, this is a marker, right? This is where we can kind of set a goal. And then the implementation might be more complex, but that's our end game. We want to be more like Estonia, or is it another place that we should be looking to?
Well, that's the challenge, right? There are academics at the top American universities who have pointed to every example worldwide of online voting and identified areas either where the voting was breached or where they believe it could have been breached or hacked. And so part of the challenge is there is no consensus that there is an analog that represents a perfect or worthy aspirational goal. And so we're largely saying, you know, what the collective conscience of all of these experts is saying is, we can borrow the best from all of these people, but collectively, the vulnerabilities have still not been solved.
So there was a lot of talk in this past U.S. presidential election about hacking, right? It was the story, and it's still playing out today.
Right.
And people often get a little bit confused with this. As far as I know, I have not seen any evidence that an actual vote was changed as a result, right? When we say that the Russians hacked the election, that's kind of a loaded term. What we mean by that is that they hacked email accounts to change the narrative, or they manipulated people's Facebook feeds or whatever. Like, that's the kind of stuff they were doing. They were trying to change the way people voted using hacking, but they weren't trying to change the actual votes, which would have been way more scandalous and crazy, in my opinion.
Well, unclear whether they were trying to change the actual votes. We don't believe they were successful in allegations of changing actual votes. I think that's right. But there are different ways you would change actual votes. I think it's just, this may be semantics, but as you put it, there's changing a vote. So I vote for candidate A and it's tallied as candidate B. Right. That's what we don't believe happened. On the other hand, there are strong allegations, seemingly credible allegations, that I wanted to change the vote of someone from A to B, and I fed them incorrect information or a false narrative. And right. that false narrative influenced people to yeah. vote for candidate B where they otherwise would have voted for candidate A.
Yeah, and I think what our policymakers are very, very concerned about is that next step, is that, okay, we had a massive disinformation campaign, which is very concerning in and of itself, and we had foreign cyber attacks on U.S. institutions like the Democratic National Committee. That said, would moving to an online voting system actually make it easier to change actual votes? Or would it make it harder? And just to provide some context here, you know, one of the things I've always been thinking about with this issue is the decentralized nature of U.S. elections could be good or bad, depending on how you interpret it. You could say, what a mess. Look at the 2000 election in Florida. If everyone just had the same damn ballot and the same system, we wouldn't be arguing over hanging chads at the Supreme Court. However, you could say, look at what Russia just did. Look at how concerning it is for foreign actors to get into our elections. And does the decentralized nature of our elections actually make it harder? Because you would have to target so many different types of systems. And some of these are very analog systems like paper ballots. Others are flipping a lever from one side to another. It's essentially a counter. But then there are also, you know, filling out a ballot, loading it into an electronic machine. And then there's actually voting using a machine. So there's all these different types of systems. Would moving online make it easier or harder for that worst case scenario of Putin changing a vote from A to B?
Well, moving it online would make it easier. I mean, which is the reason that today we're not equipped to offer our elections online. But when I say our elections online, we have 519,000 elected officials in the United States, including in one district, Dog Catcher. Now, I appreciate the immense vulnerability and the Russian desire to hack the presidential election, but it's not clear that the Russians would want to hack the Dog Catcher election or right. a PTA election. And so there's a lot of learning to be done over a prolonged period of time. None of our elections are conducted online. None of them. And not all of them impact our national security. If Putin was going to hack a American election, and we had online voting, how that would occur. I mean, what or anyone were to hack an American election. I mean, we know that malware is installed on computers is not an edge case, right? And so there is the possibility, not just, you know, that there is the vulnerability that when you vote from your computer, that you think you're voting for A, but it's recorded as a vote for candidate B. We know that during transmission, that vote can be switched. We know that during tabulation, it's conceptually possible that there are 100 votes for candidate A and 90 votes for candidate B, but because there's hacking at the point of tabulation, those tallies are reversed. We also know that there's a point of vulnerability in something like the databases where all the registered voters exist. So this is not a simple problem.
But then there's also the phenomenon of the blockchain. And while most people think of blockchain in the context of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, one could imagine it being used in healthcare and voting and other areas where trust is so important and trust could be achieved through encryption and technology. Is that a conversation that anyone is having? And given the fact that Congress is so seemingly out of touch with new technologies a lot of the time, aside from some very pioneering members, is that even a conversation that policymakers are ready to have?
So all of the companies that are engaged as a business in building online voting applications are considering, or in one case, I spoke with a startup that is focused on using blockchain for voting. Now, it's worth pointing out that even blockchains have been hacked. For those of your
no such thing as 100% security,
right? but there's other ways you would deal with this, right? You could perform some type of statistical analysis, regression analysis, where you're looking at, you know, do these votes correlate with what we would otherwise expect these people to have voted? So we don't need to necessarily examine every vote that's been cast, but can we use some type of analysis which tells us which votes to drill down on and look for hacking?
Is there irregularities that we can see in the system and then view them on a case-by-case basis and deal with those harms as they come?
That's right. I mean, what I would say is if I was in charge of policy, and as you correctly point out, we don't have a national, we have national standards, suggestions, if you will, but we don't have a national agency that runs our voting. Voting is conducted county by county with state guidance. But if I was trying to advise people on how we should approach voting, I would approach it the same way you approach any technology problem, which is you start with what's the objective. Now, not even everyone is on the same page about the objective. Some people would tell you getting people that are uninformed about candidates, getting them to vote is not a social good. I happen to believe it is. It is a national good. It'd be nice if people were well informed, but setting the criteria by which they're informed before they can vote. I think
there's an ugly history there with poll tests. So let's not go down that road.
Yeah, I think it's crazy. So the way I would approach this is I would say, okay, what is the objective? Now, the objective I would say is let's get everyone to vote, or as many people as we possibly can to vote. And then the question is, what level of certainty do we need that a system is hack-proof? Now, it's naive to say that level of certainty has to be 100% when we know we're not at 100% now. So now, it is true that we need a greater level of certainty, perhaps exponentially greater level of certainty than a bank does. A bank assumes that they are going to suffer some percentage of losses associated with hacking, and they can tolerate that. We, for example, as a country, could not tolerate 1% of our votes being switched. But the question is, what could we tolerate? And by the way, maybe we can tolerate none of our votes being switched, but that doesn't mean that we would have 100% certainty that none of them were capable of being switched. So then I would engage in a debate about what the standard should be. I don't know the answer to that question, what the standard should be. But if we started there and we said, what's the goal? The goal is more people voting. And then we said, what should the standard be? Again, I think we would need to have a dialogue with experts about what the standard should be. Then I would say, well, how do we encourage that goal with that standard for elections that do not involve national security in the short term?
So what can we expect going forward, right? So let's assume for the sake of this hypothetical that every elected representative shares your goal of increasing turnout. Let's just assume for a hypothetical, right? Because let's imagine a world where we're trying to achieve this goal. What would need to change at the local level, state level, or federal level, and to allow this experimentation needed? Because this is not going to be an overnight switch. We're not going to just flip a switch and say online voting. I can imagine that this will be something that is tested, and maybe we try it in certain elections, see how it goes. Maybe it's in those less impactful elections like dog catcher that we actually get to test the system. But just a couple, questions to throw at you to end the show. What would need to change from a policy standpoint, and how do you see this playing out? Do you see an iterative process where people experiment, or will it take a crisis, or will it take a major event to push us in that direction?
Well, crises will push us in the opposite direction. What is likely to push us in the direction of online voting is funding available at the local level to experiment. And a sense that we're engaged in a national dialogue about these things that I talked about, which is what's the goal, which I think is a much bigger problem. Like, if we were all on board that getting more people to vote was a good thing, we would not be engaged. And, if we were all on board with this idea of a representative democracy consists of one person, one vote, we would not be engaged in things like gerrymandering. We would not be engaged in things like in switching the day of our elections.
Or suppression efforts and things like that.
We wouldn't have an electoral college, right? Electoral college is, it's inherently anti-democratic. So,
well, I'm sure there are some people who would disagree with you there. And I'll just say, for my purposes, I'm not sure that the Electoral College and online voting and increased turnout are all mutually exclusive. I could imagine a future where the Electoral College is still there, but more people are voting because of online voting, just to throw that caveat out.
Maybe, but you started this podcast by talking about the fact that one of the reasons people don't vote is they don't believe their votes count. So if you are in a decidedly blue state or a decidedly red state and you don't believe your vote counts and internet voting is available, your point was that may not do it.
So that might not, but you also brought up the very important point that this might change who votes. And it's very hard to foresee how such a massive change in the way we vote would change the states and how they turn out. And I bet people who used to think Pennsylvania was solid blue have just certainly changed their mind about that after this election. So I definitely take your point about the Electoral College, and it's absolutely fair, and a lot of people feel that way. I would just offer the counterpoint that I don't think the Electoral College is mutually exclusive with having online voting and having increased civic participation.
That's right. It's not mutually exclusive, but it's all that's right. We may increment our way to getting more people to vote with any one of these solutions, moving the day in which we vote, same day voter registration, greater availability of polls, online voting. But the Electoral College is one of the major problems. You know, when you think about, a lot of people characterize, we just have a cultural issue where Americans are less engaged and therefore they vote at lower numbers. That's not obvious. I mean, I know a lot of people think that, and you hear that from a lot of European folks that have high percentages of voting. But when you have all of these factors that are contributing to suppressing voting in the United States, it's not clear which one to point to. Now, you're right. Yeah. We don't have an electoral college, and the mayor for a race for the mayor of New York or for a city council person, and our turnouts are horrific. So there's got to be some component of culture has to play some role in that. But, you know, quantifying what role that is, I don't know.
Right. Well, then I guess we're going to have to leave it there. But there's a lot of interesting things to consider going forward. And perhaps the first step is just getting people to agree that increasing voter turnout is a good thing.
Yeah.
And then if we get that, then I could imagine that, you know, as with many technologies, we experiment, we innovate, we iterate, that testing these things out in kind of lower stakes environments with proper protections and controls in place to allow for scientific study could push us in that direction. And having countries like Estonia and others to look at and study will also help. But this is going to be a fascinating topic, and I look forward to hearing about it on your podcast. And listeners, you should go ahead and subscribe to that podcast. It's called Predicting Our Future, and I assume people can find it wherever they get their podcasts.
Really enjoyed the conversation. I couldn't agree more with how you concluded with starting local, setting objectives, and going from there.
Yeah, you got to build change from the bottom up, right? My guest has been Andrew Weinrich, tech entrepreneur and host of Predicting Our Future. Andrew, this was a great discussion. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Tech Freedom. Let us know what you think of the show. Send us an email at media@techfreedom.org. Find this podcast in the iTunes store along with Andrew's, where you can please leave us both reviews because it will help others find our shows. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.